Welcome back to the Film Experience. I'm your host, Nathaniel. I'm here with Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks and Joe Reed from The Atlantic. This week we're talking about Wild and Foxcatcher. Wild just expanded, so we figured it was a good time to post this. We actually recorded a couple weeks ago, so here you go. We all know Joe is a huge fan of Reese Witherspoon.
Wait, he is?
And I'm actually a huge fan of this movie, but I don't really know what Nick thinks of it.
Right down the middle.
Okay. Before we begin, I just wanted to mention I was recently at a Wild event, and what was interesting about it was Cheryl Strayed is freaking hilarious in person. I don't know if any of you have heard her interviewed or anything.
I haven't.
But she is so lively, so it suddenly made the casting of Reese Witherspoon make so much sense. She didn't have pretense about her, which I was kind of expecting, given all the sort of soul-searching of the topic.
Yeah.
Like, you'd think she would be heavy-handed about it, but in person she's very, you know, sort of relaxed about it. And
well, I think that's one of the things I liked about the movie. I think from the trailer, and I think this sort of bears out in talking to some people who, I know a lot of people walked into this movie with a good amount of dread, and part of that is because a lot of people bring in their baggage about Reese with them, but I think a lot of it is also that, I mean, I thought it was a good trailer, but I think you get the sense that this is going to be one of those sort of ponderous, you know, that soul searching with air quotes around it, where
yeah.
It comes this sort of tedious sense for some hippy dippy, new agey like maxim that you found deep within yourself. And I think one of the good things about the movie that I thought was that it just feels very kind of lived in and tactile and earned in a lot of ways, where it doesn't feel like there are it seems like these kind of movies can't quite get away from that trope where, like, she sees the lonely fox on the path and they look at each other and they see something in each other's eyes and whatever, and it's like there's that, but I think it's that kind of thing is so much more. I think the whole thing feels less new agey than maybe people expected going in.
Yeah,
and
just,
like, even to the extent that, like, it's kind of gutsy that they have. She has that conversation on the phone where she's asking the person that's in the trailer to complete her sentence about, you know, why am I walking 1,000 miles? And for better and for worse, I thought I left the movie still kind of not knowing how to finish that sentence, sort of. And in a way, I kind of admired that in tandem with something else I felt ambivalent about, which is what felt to me like a kind of lack of punctuation point at the end. Like, when she gets to the end of the journey, spoiler,
yeah.
But when she gets to the end of walking, the movie treats that pretty offhandedly, which was a clear signal that it was never about getting anywhere. I mean, I understood that, and I kind of admired that, but I just also kind of walked out of the movie feeling a little bit vague.
It's funny that you say that, though, because and I think I agree in terms of what the movie gives you at the end, and yet I remember very clearly feeling a sort of surging sense of triumph for this character, and I feel like the audience that I was with, it was one of those very kind of like everybody in the room is on the same wavelength moments. I've mentioned this to a couple of people since I saw it, but it was really, really something where, like, there was this wave of sort of good feeling for not only, like, the character of Cheryl Strayed in the movie, but for Reese Witherspoon. But I think there is this sense, I think because the movie does a good job, and I think because Reese does a good job of sort of getting you not just on her side, but sort of, like, in it with her, that the end, to me, felt really like something.
I mean, I agree. Like, the ending to me was very moving, and I think its vagueness is part of why it's so moving, because you can, I mean, you might think that the movie's not earning it in this way, but because you can actually project onto it, because it's not forcing you into any specific answer about how you forgive yourself or how you move on from, you know, one chapter of your life that you desperately need to move on from. And I think I found it so moving, the ending.
Yeah.
And moving especially for its offhandedness that Nick is talking about. Like, it didn't feel like it was trying to force this epiphany. It just was there to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I can understand why that would be a very subjective, you know, thing to experience in a movie and not necessarily sure. something that would work at all the same from viewer to viewer.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember... You know, when Nick, you had said you were sort of in the middle about it, I remember, like, when Reese did, when she started the resurgence and she started getting serious again, that a lot of people, myself included, thought she was extremely vague and mud and, like, what do I know about this character?
Uh-huh.
And I didn't, so, like, I didn't feel that at all this time. Even though the character, even though there is a lot of ambiguity built into the whole vehicle,
yeah,
about why she is the way she is and why she's, you know, making these changes that she's making, but something just felt inherently different about it. Maybe that Reese understood it better, even if she wasn't going to spell anything out.
Well, it's interesting to contrast this movie with Dallas Buyers Club, which I've sort of tried to do. A few times, obviously because of the Jean-Marc Vallée connection.
Right.
The relationships between the characters felt frustratingly soft focusy, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
Like, I didn't really ever feel like I truly bought into even McConaughey and Leto's characters' relationship, much less McConaughey and Jennifer Garner, you know, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Where this, I think with most of the time, far less screen time together, I completely was on board with Reese and Laura Dern, with Cheryl and her brother, with Cheryl and her ex-husband that you see in flashbacks.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I don't want to put that entirely on the actors, because I think Vallée does a better job of directing this than he does in Dallas Buyers Club. But it's really hard for me to put a finger on it beyond the fact that I think I really was connected to these relationships in a way that I wasn't in Dallas Buyers Club.
I guess I felt sort of the opposite, which didn't, you know, come... I mean, again, I'm kind of fine with Wilde. I just don't have any intense movements in any direction. But I felt... I did feel like the direction was really similar across the two movies, but the reason I found that interesting in Dallas Buyers Club was that I felt like that film played for me as a kind of conversation between what was kind of triumphant in Woodruff's story and what was kind of unwinnable in that story at the same time. And the movie felt kind of sad and invigorated at the same time. And in this movie, I guess it did not... I do have my favorite memories from Wilde tend to be personal encounters like the ones you're talking about that we don't get a ton of time with. I think I was even more excited about the one scene things like the Hobo Times guy or mm-hmm. the woman who catches up with her and is like, oh my God, it's so great to meet the only other woman
yeah.
doing this.
Yeah.
Picaresque encounters I really liked. But in the sense of the bigger conversations that I thought the movie was premised on, like the conversation between her headspace and the landscape, I didn't really feel like those two tracks of the movie really served each other. Like, when we would cut back and forth between her thoughts and her movements, I didn't really get a lot out of that. And even some of the stuff with the mom, I liked both of those actresses in their scenes together, but I don't know if it's just that I wanted to be a little, like, dig a little further into, like, this sounds horrible to say because who can't understand why losing your parent would be traumatic? But Cheryl's investment in her mom seems pretty, like, really intense. And I did not feel like I understood it much more than I did, I don't know, I guess it applies to her whole journey. Like, I kept admiring the movie for things it wasn't doing, becoming more obvious or more triumphal
right,
or
whatever right.
I talked about, but I couldn't get too excited about what I was watching. Which doesn't mean I just liked it.
Right. It is a movie about such a personal experience that it's mm-hmm. fascinating to me that, could they were even not disagreeing per se, but that we all feel quite differently about it.
Yeah.
Thing, which I think is very cool. But I also, what the thing, one thing I liked about it that I don't hear people talking about at all is the sort of production of it, like the more technical elements.
Mm.
Like, I thought it's sort of, its headspace with like cinematography and sound design were they did remind me a tiny bit of Dallas Buyers Club, but I just think they were so much more fitting to the material here. The way that the sound sometimes didn't exactly feel like it was happening, but remembered.
No, I know what you're talking about. And also along that same line, that I liked that the voiceover was less expository and more headspace, I think, like you said, Nathaniel, where it felt like just sort of where she's singing these dumb songs to each other, and she's just sort of like pushing herself along, and it feels like it feels necessary because you need to have something to accompany just walking. But it also felt like it could have been, it wasn't this sort of shortcut to exposition in a way that voiceover can often be. And I felt like it was a great window into the personality of this woman.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the reason I bring that up is that I think the conversation about the movie has been very, has been way too narrowed in on sort of like a one character monologue type of thing. Because I think the movie has a lot more going for it than just, oh, Reese is giving a good performance. You know, and that does tend to happen to pictures, though, whichever is the most easy point to focus on is what everybody focuses on, and then they don't think about the rest of it, which sort of aggravates me if I feel like the whole team is doing really good work.
Yeah, again, I mean, not to bring it back to Dallas Buyers Club again, and I know that other people liked that movie better than I did, and I didn't hate it, but it's that this movie is being boiled down to just one performance, and that movie seemed to be taken more on its own merits as a whole. It's irksome to me.
Yeah,
because I feel like if anything, the opposite should be true.
Yeah, I kind of feel that way too. But Nick, I think you have the opposite reaction again.
I do, but that's what I mean. It does kind of both movies are interesting to me by being paired in that way. You know, that in a lot of ways, I did feel like I was seeing a directorial style kind of reprise itself, and to have made both of those movies not only so quickly, like in terms of the time elapsed between them not being very much, but you know, the filming of Dallas Buyers Club itself was so fast, and it just felt to me like a his directorial point of view had not changed in many ways from one to the next, but that different people could react so differently to the two of them is interesting, and it does make me wonder what his kind of, you know, if we're going to see these same techniques change in a kind of significant way with whatever he does next or not. It also, I do think that for as much as he's been quite voluble about the death of his own mother, and Reese Witherspoon has talked a lot about her mother's influence on her choice to make this story, or just the sheer producing labor of getting it off the ground, like, it's amazing that it doesn't feel more kind of boutique or more like the filmmaker's doing something for themselves. Like, I think this movie will probably be in conversation with Still Alice for a lot of this season, probably. And that movie does feel to me like it has some things going for it, but really is about giving Julianne Moore a vehicle. And this movie, I agree with you, doesn't feel like that, even though there are so many reasons why any of them could have been at risk of really making this about themselves.
It just doesn't feel like a vanity project.
It doesn't. Yeah, in a way, it seems strange to say, but in a way, it even, she's in like every frame of the movie, but doesn't absolutely feel like its center. Like, I felt like the center of the movie was the editing. And like seeing somebody's past and their current situation be in conversation and kind of toggling back and forth. It's not like I didn't experience it as a kind of deep plumbing of that character's personality. Like, you're intuitively picking up a whole bunch of stuff, but it's not exactly the movie you would make if you were just setting it up as a star vehicle.
Yeah, so a lot to think about. If you haven't seen the movie, you should go see it and join this conversation, since it'll feel personal to you in some ways that we can't predict.
And fucking buy a ticket, because, you know, it's like the only, especially since, like, you know, Still Alice is still like, is it released? Is it not? What's going on? Are they going to take it away? Like, there's so few movies out there to do a dollar vote and show them that we do show up, not only for stories about women, but sort of watching things like The Homesman and the other movies that are out right now in limited release. just aren't getting audiences to turn up. And they're really different movies, and you can see in each individual case why they'd have a you know, kind of tougher hill to climb.
Right.
We keep using hill climbing metaphors, and I can't imagine why. But but it does seem, you know, and I see it happening with the boy movies too, like where people have commented that Whiplash doesn't seem to be building momentum in the way that you might have expected. But
right. Well, and on the flip side of that coin, like, I'm sure Annie's going to do well. You know what I mean? But it's like...
And then we can finally get the movie I Want, which is Quvenzhané walking from New Orleans, possibly as Hush Puppy, to Ontario.
And not singing at all.
So, Foxcatcher, the immediate point that I want to bring up, because I find it so interesting, because Nick, I thought you and I were simpatico on this movie, only to hear on Twitter today that we're absolutely in opposite places with the performances.
Oh, yeah, we might be, I guess.
Which surprised me, because I thought you and I were right the same about the movie as a whole, which maybe
guys,
we are.
Is this about Vanessa Redgrave? I can't have about Vanessa Redgrave. I can't
it might
have
be one of the few things that is not about Vanessa Redgrave, because most things are. But
if they had a scene of her catching a fox,
right,
the movie would have been better, because then she would have had a reason to be in the movie at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was interested in Steve Carell every moment he was on the screen. I got more and more interested in Mark Ruffalo, so much so that by the end of the movie, he and Steve Carell were both really interesting to me. And Channing Tatum was the one that, he wasn't doing anything wrong, but I never got any new ideas from his performance beyond what was in the script. And he's who I would, you know, dump in the Do Dumper Mary, I guess, of Foxcatcher performance response.
Interesting.
And I think that is not where you guys were.
That is the exact opposite of me.
Yeah.
Although we meet in the middle on Mark Ruffalo, because I did think he was fascinating and got more interesting as the movie went.
Wait, so Nick, who's your do, who's your dump, who's your marry?
Well, I guess I would marry Steve Carell, since I was into him the whole time, okay. Right? And then I would even say, and here's where I really go, you know, put all my chips on the table, that I was less distracted by Steve Carell's nose than by Channing Tatum's and Mark Ruffalo's weird hair makeup stylings.
Whoa.
Like, they felt like I was, we were this close to a J. Edgar place of like, I can't look at this. Or maybe the Joseph Gordon-Levitt weird looper, like, these are 12 ways to not look like Bruce Willis, but I see you guys are still trying between every take. Like, it felt a little bit like I wasn't looking at people sometimes with those guys. But that's all superficial anyway. Steve Carell.
I don't know why you would say the word superficial in a movie with Channing Tatum in a singlet.
Well, I did have occasion today to click your label for Oscar race.
Uh-huh.
I was looking for your post where you gave all the calendar dates for when things are happening. And so when I saw those back-to-back, and there was the interview with Daniel Ribeiro, the way he looks guy, and your picture was the lead shirtless, and then the next post was Foxcatcher, and it was Channing Tatum shirtless. Oh, you know, it's just some patterns began to emerge.
Listen, those bills aren't going to pay themselves.
That's right.
No, I feel like it's funny. I think I'm the opposite of you in that regard, specifically, Nick, in that everything about Steve Carell's visage in that movie I found to be distracting, and I found to be caricaturish, and I found to be distancing, but not in the way I don't think that they wanted it to be distancing. I know he's supposed to be like, that is his character, he's sort of this like isolated, perched in a fortress in, you know, Pennsylvania, where are we?
Yep.
But I thought the stuff with Tatum and Ruffalo felt really lived in, really experiential, very much like that scene early on, and I know I'm not the only one who's brought this up, but that scene early on where the two of them are wrestling and there's no dialogue and it sort of goes on forever.
Yeah.
And it's Grizzly Man, basically, except they don't shit while they do it.
One of my favorite scenes in a movie all year, I think, just in terms of what that communicates and how you sort of got their relationship and how both of them sort of enter the world. They enter the world as this sort of loping, physical, you know, Neanderthal kind of creatures, but in a way that felt real, where Carell just seems
like their authentic selves, even right. though it's not, even though we're more verbal.
Carell felt like he was creating the Penguin to me. I don't know.
You know what? I kept like the reason that I glommed onto your feeling about that, Nick, is I assumed you'd have the opposite reaction because not because I had it because I'm not that narcissistic, but because I often think of your ideas about movies because they fascinate me. And one of the things that you have said before about Wes Anderson movies, and I know that's a long leap from Bennett Miller, but one of the things you've said about Wes Anderson is that you wish that actors wouldn't go into it saying, I'm going to give a Wes Anderson performance the type I've seen in these movies. And I felt the whole time that all of Bennett Miller's like sort of atmospheric power as a filmmaker, which is often very chilly and observational and sort of I don't want to say off-putting, but unconcerned with your emotional well-being, you know, while you're watching it, seemed to be what Steve Carell was going for. So he was working, he was doing exactly what Bennett Miller already provides, which to me really bothered me because I was like, you have to do something else because the movie's already so oppressive that way.
I did find the movie very oppressive that way, and I my memory, you guys should tell me if I'm wrong, is that all three of us had something like that reaction of the movie is just so environmentally heavy.
Yeah.
And I do find the direction in it not just suffocating as an experience, because I think none of the three of us, you know, all three of us are people who are, and many of the people listening to this are happy to, you know, sit through an ordeal if that's what the movie's about. Like, right. I need it to be lighter. But I do feel like from the minute that the movie starts, that it's the color palette, the distance of the camera, the music, the sound, like, it's all just editorializing on what you're watching as a heavy American tragedy about a big idea. Mm-hmm. And then the big idea starts to pretty obviously be about social class. And there was just never any space for the story to kind of unfold itself without our this huge overlay of what the filmmakers had decided how resonant this was. So, but actually within that, I totally hear, Joe, like what you're saying about, I mean, I know you're both saying it, but about the mannerisms or the kind of penguininess, not just in like kind of physiognomy, but there is, I hear what you're both saying, but I felt like things that Steve Carell was suggesting through really weird little waves of his hands or through kind of strange antic details during that scene where they're all rejoicing when they've won. And I thought he was getting out from under the movie, or at least suggesting that he'd thought more things about the character than, I don't know that Channing Tatum's doing the wrong thing by tamping down as heavily as he does. But he felt to me more consistent with the oppressive thesisness of the movie, that I'm playing a brute who is lured into somebody's plan, and that is the tragedy of of me. And one could even say Vanessa Redgrave gets conscripted into that and can't find much else to do besides be a conveniently psychologized, maybe he's this way because of his mother.
Vanessa Redgrave might as well have been a talking portrait on the wall.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Or just a portrait on the wall.
It's her voice.
She didn't even say anything.
The movie tends to succeed better in moments where dread enters the room unexpectedly, and it's hard for that movie to achieve that because the atmosphere makes you expect it so often.
Right.
Yeah.
But like the part where he walks into the gym and he's got the gun.
Yeah,
and you don't really see it right away,
yeah.
And he doesn't move it. You just sort of, your eye travels to his hand eventually.
Yeah,
you see it, that kind of stuff, or even like Channing like bashing his head into the mirror. also feels like it comes out of nowhere in a way that, like, not enough things in the movie do.
Yeah, so I was waiting for those moments where it had some sort of life other than the life. It was like Bennett Miller was like this controlling parent who would not let his child be anything other than what he envisioned at all times.
That's totally it. I mean, like, when you said before what Bennett Miller is like as a director, I feel like between The Cruise and Capote and Moneyball, it became quite difficult to say what Bennett Miller is like as a director. And I know a lot of people I have read use that as a criticism of him, that he didn't have much of a signature, or, you know, his nomination for directing Capote seemed to be taken not very generously by some people, that, that it was just such an anonymous style. But those were three such different, like, the Moneyball just stands out for me as in its looseness. And, you know, Capote is anything but that, and The Cruise is such a strange little object. And this movie makes Capote seem more like a house style than I didn't associate him with a house style. Right. And especially when you get closer to the ending. I mean, I admitted to you guys at the time that I had misremembered who was going to die in this movie. There were a lot of things about the choreography of that climactic moment that I think are really powerful. But after the shooting has happened, almost everything that happens for the next 5 minutes I thought was really terrible, to include it just takes whole shots from Capote, or just gets so interested in, like, black landscapes against white skies and heavy weather, literally. And then when I read, you know, like, Mark Harris's big story about, you know, the set of Foxcatcher and Miller's career, I know we're all predisposed to kind of valorize directors who really hold on to projects that are precarious through the studio system, and they would get shut down and then they're back on. But this did feel maybe like a little too worked over, or maybe like people had thought about this story for too long or given it too much significance. Or
Yeah, I think that's why my favorite scene is a scene that doesn't feel like, to me, that much like the rest of the movie, is the interview scene where it's just Mark Ruffalo's face.
Oh, great, yes.
Because that was one of the only scenes where I felt, like, danger in a way that completely unlike everything else that's dangerous in the movie. Like, that danger was about he would lose his soul if he said this word. And he was completely aware that he could not.
Yep.
And so then the whole drama is, how does an actor play a scene where the character himself is performing and realizes he can't perform, played by a great performer? I mean, it was a completely fascinating scene, but to me that was Mark Ruffalo rescuing his role from the oppression of the movie, just as much as it was his character, you know, realizing I can't be in this oppressive, you know, role that's been written for me.
I think he gives the performance that I find realist, it seems like a cop-out, and I hate saying that, but, like, that is true. Like, it feels like the performance that feels breathable enough to feel real.
I agree.
Yeah. So, I have to ask this, since we all think about these things. What did you guys make of the sort of... It's not subtextually gay, but it's definitely not...
Oh, I think it is.
It's definitely not...
Wait, what is it?
Heterosexual. But it also doesn't feel gay. It's very strange. The sexuality is very strange. So
it is the sexuality in general of the movie.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Like, did you just interpret it as sort of latent homosexuality? Like, I wasn't, like, uncomfortable with, you know, the suggestions, but I just didn't. It just was odd to me. Like, I'm not sure that there was a clear decision made about it other than, ooh, they have a weird relationship.
Well, I think there are ways to read into something like that, where if you're talking about the bigger themes of the movie and the sort of lionization / covetousness that DuPont has towards Mark, I can see where, like sexuality makes a perfect sense in there. And that, I mean... And there's also this coded stuff where, like, you know, mother won't approve, like, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That feels almost like celluloid closety.
Almost, and almost camp.
Yeah,
but oh, not committed to it or something.
Not enough courage or the conviction to go full camp. Sometimes I sort of wish that the Foxcatcher story had been made with the kind of attitude that Nightcrawler has. And I feel like maybe that then has a little bit more of a willingness to go into camp.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not... I don't fully love Nightcrawler either, but I wonder if maybe that the combination of those two, of the style of Nightcrawler and the story of Foxcatcher, gives me one movie that I really love rather than two that I wish I liked more.
Hmm.
Yeah, I agree that Nightcrawler, to me, does a more satisfying job of seeming kind of very particular to its freaky characters and balancing that with some bigger attempt at a statement, mm-hmm. or to feel so tilted toward the statement. So, yeah, I think I agree. I about the gayness, I mean, I have been reading posts that you probably guys have been reading the same ones about how the movie seems to really double down on some of that homoeroticism and try to lean in pretty heavily to suggesting that that was part of DuPont's attraction to these wrestlers, and then it, at the same time, really downplays the fairly open secret of his paranoid schizophrenia and his history with diagnosed mental illness,
mm-hmm.
and that the film does feel a lot more behind the candelabra and a lot less of what it seems like people who remember the story were describing, and what I think would make a lot more sense. You know, it's a story about how all of us convince ourselves to work for people who we know to be unreliable, you know, or deeply flawed or whatever, right. And yet they're providing you with what you need, or if you see no other options to get what you need, you suck it up and push through it.
Right.
Which did seem like a viable story, and sometimes the movie was even telling that story with the weird shit about him ordering tanks to the house, or the there will be bloody kind of philatelist conversation. Like there were moments where this movie reminded me of that one, just in bordering on surrealism in the way it was trying to evoke the kind of character's mania. But the not to talk about the hours, which was not my agenda to do right now, but I remember talking to a friend in grad school about why she didn't like the hours, and she was like, I think you're not supposed to say things like this, but sometimes I just want to be like, guys, maybe just write about guys. It's cool. Like, you don't have to pretend like you can see into the lives of women. We've got it. It's okay. Don't worry about diversity. Just talk about guys. And this did feel a little bit like, I know this is ungenerous of me, but it felt like a movie made by straight people who were going to get a certain amount of credit for adding homoeroticism to their checklist of themes, but did not actually seem able to participate in the homoeroticism, nor did they have anything particularly remarkable to say about it. It felt like a sort of shorthand for obsession. Mm-hmm. And I felt like John DuPont's obsessive relationship to wrestling, to this particular wrestler, to Olympic glory, was all weirder than a kind of condensable prognosis, like
yes.
latent homoeroticism. And so I did resent a little bit the movie leaning on that and then not seeming like it had much to do with that.
Right, because it does lean, I guess that was my confusion about it, because it does really lean into that, but it just doesn't read authentically enough for me to think that that's what they were going for, but now I'm changing my mind. They were going for it, I just don't think that they nailed it. Excuse the phrase, nailed it.
Yeah. I will not excuse that.
Because, like, for example, because especially, like, once Mark or Dave, whoever he is, dyes his hair.
Yes.
And then it becomes like this weird, okay, so now he's like sort of your rent boy. There were that had a really weird vibe where sort of he had sort of like given into that, you know, that DuPont is his John. Like, it was very,
that was the most behind the candelabra of everything.
Yeah.
And it was an instance too where I did not feel like Channing Tatum was helping me understand that any more than the filmmakers were not helping me understand that. Like, no mm-hmm. one was helping me understand that.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. This has been an illuminating conversation.
What do you guys make of its... I don't feel like I could even characterize what the movie's reception has been. I can't quite work out whether critics have been mostly for it or lukewarm about it.
It feels like it's remained by default an awards contender, and yet has not attracted a single... It keeps getting all these special distinction prizes for everyone.
Yeah.
So consider it separately from absolutely everything else, and kind of gesture to, we admire you.
But to me, that's totally in keeping with what the movie's whole vibe.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this everything being preordained. You know?
Yeah, I was sort of having a series of discussions with people on Twitter about this today as the different awards were sort of filtering out, and we were talking about whether Carell is going to make it into Best Actor, and I think that he will, based on not necessarily the movie. I think this is going to be one of those things where you're probably going to see one or two actors nominated and not really anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Carell, with just the physical transformation, I think he'll be able to sort of like dine out on that enough that it'll get him through. I think
sounds so crass, but I see what
you're saying. No, but you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. I do know what you mean. It's just funny.
And it doesn't entirely surprise me that he hasn't really shown up in the Critics Awards. I think he's going to end up with he'll get a Globe nomination, he'll get a SAG nomination, and he'll be sort of that third or fourth slot. I think by the end of the next couple weeks, that's my prediction at least. Was that what you were asking? Did I just take things into a crass awardsy place? Should I have done that?
No, that is kind of what I was asking. It's just, I think I felt at Cannes like I was being told that of all the American movies playing there, this is the one that really is bona fide.
Right.
And that people are going to be really stumping for it. And then when it landed, it seemed to be received really enthusiastically, but very quickly you got the sense that people not only weren't all sold on it, but there was a strong sense of having been sold a bill of goods or something. And that he really seemed to catch a lot of the... some of the things that sometimes can just coast you through an awards campaign seem to have backfired already for him. Like, people are really on guard about the prostheses or the comic actor showing you he can do drama. So now it's been 6 months since I've heard anybody say anything particularly nice about his performance, which we disagree about how much we all like it, but mm-hmm. I'm just surprised that as a general conversation, he always shows up on the list of things people think might happen, but I can't think of more than three people who have praised him.
Well, I think that I think this points to a larger problem that we have with award season, and that is a problem, an ongoing problem that is not getting any better, in that movies don't have an organic life outside that contributes to their awards campaign. Their life is the awards campaign.
Yeah.
And the reason that keeps happening is all of this time between premieres and pitching something to when actually people can experience and discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps happening. And this year I think has been particularly bad about that for a lot of movies. I mean, we had that last year with August Osage County in particular that was like sort of hiding. And so everybody had made up their minds of who they were going to love best about it before anybody had seen it. And that had weird festival responses too. This had a great festival response and then a middling festival response and then a sort of in between when it came out. And I just don't think the way things are presented and when they're pitched so heavily, and the movie's already pitching itself as an awards contender, even within itself, let alone its campaign.
Mm-hmm.
So I just don't think it can have that sort of organic life, and I think that's where the confusion stems from about, like, what do people really think of it?
Yeah, it does kind of parallel the problem of the directorial style that we talked about, right? That it's been so smothered by the expectation of it
mm-hmm.
as a certain kind of movie that will kind of thread the needle of being critically embraceable but also Oscar friendly,
right?
And it does feel like all of us would probably agree that it is a stranger movie than any of that would imply, right?
Yes.
But and a slightly harder movie to recommend to people. Like, I think the trailer is so fantastic. The trailers have repeatedly been fantastic, but whenever I'm at a movie with somebody and they go, God, I really want to see that, I don't know whether to encourage them to go or not. It's a weird object for sure. It feels to me like the kind of movie too, like, I can see the outcome, Joe, that you were describing of the two actors and nothing else. It also feels like the kind of thing that could get a writing nomination and nothing else. Like, I don't know.
Or tons of things or nothing at all.
Yeah, any of those. Yeah.
But it does seem like the best picture possibility has come and gone, right?
What?
It does seem like the best picture nomination possibility has maybe come and gone.
Yeah, I think so.
There are people who I think I've talked to a few people who it's their top one or two movies of the year, but it just doesn't seem like those people are coalescing at all.
It's also kind of not clear where their camp is, right? Like, if you're an Under the Skin fan, you know not to talk to Oscar people. And if you're an Imitation Game fan, you can be right in the middle of this. But if I were a Foxcatcher advocate, I would not know who my group was. Like, should I be treating this as a Nightcrawler, kind of destined to be overlooked? Should I be treating this as, like, a major contender that I want to advocate for? Is it an underdog or an overdog? It's one of those, but I can't figure out what it is.
Like, well, if it's a Channing Tatum, it's an underdog. If it's a Steve Carell, it's an overdog.
Okay.
As the wrestling scene implies.
Well, I feel like just look at what it did with the Independent Spirit Awards, where it's there, but it's not there. Like you were saying, it's like...
It's not eligible, and they felt the need to give it an award anyways.
Right. So it's like a very uncomfortable middle ground, where it's too... You know, too much of a boy for, you know, Crazy Town, too crazy for Boys Town. Like, it's just, it's my job to bring the Simpsons references to this podcast. That's what I do. That's what I'm here for.
I'm waiting for people to start using Bob's Burgers references and everything. Oh,
God. I was just writing about that show the other day for a year-end thing. I love it.
It's so brilliant. I can't even believe really I held out as long as I did. Okay, well, wow, we've been talking a long time.
Yeah.
Yay! Yay, movies that are confusing.
Yeah.
But still worth seeing.
Yeah.
So that you can have an opinion about it or not, or wonder what your opinion is even after you've seen it.
Go see Foxcatcher and be as vexed as we are.
Help us. Help ourselves.
Yeah. All right, thanks again to Nick Davis from Nick's Flick Picks.
I am ambiguously a lead and a support.
And Joe Reed from The Atlantic.
I don't like to see this podcast being low.
And I'm Nathaniel from The Film Experience. Thanks again. Bye.